Major funding for the connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Nearly 60 years ago, as American bombers flew their final missions over France, there were people on the ground who grumbled about the Yankee liberators. The French complained that the Americans had been indiscriminate. Years later, signs on ruined buildings announced "Écrasé par les Américains," bombed by the Americans. It is a part of the ill will that has always marked Franco-American relations. U.S. administrations have frequently expressed frustration with the French when they built their own nuclear arsenal, when they walked out of NATO. Part of it is a French resistance to the Anglo-alliances of modern history. FDR and Churchill, Reagan and Thatcher, Bush and Blair. And now, at the UN, the latest split between France and the U.S. threatens Security Council unanimity over Iraq. Connection listeners, what is it that feeds the historic antipathy between the French and the Americans? Is it rooted in the past? Is it curled up in the cultural DNA of the two countries? And is the current fracas a serious split? Or is it just tradition? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. With us today, Ezra Suleiman. He is IBM Professor of International Studies and Director of the Committee for European Studies at Princeton University. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
And Annie Cohen-Salal, Professor at the School of Advanced Studies in Social Sciences in Paris, is joining us. Annie's also Chair of American Studies at the University of Caen in Normandy. Annie, welcome back to The Connection.
Thank you. Hello.
You teach American studies in a French university. Is anybody coming to class these days?
Yeah, that's pretty hard. That's pretty hard. There are a lot of resistance in France about teaching American studies, and Ezra knows about it. It is not easy for the French to go with people who are on the same level as them. The French know very well how to teach North-South relations. France has been a long-time empire, and France has known how to talk to the previous colonized country. But even when I was a diplomat, it was difficult to discuss the dialogue, North-North dialogue. So the French are not at ease with dealing with what a French foreign minister called the hyperpuissance. Therefore, American studies are not well developed in France, and I think that's one of the roots of the problem. You know, in the press, the way the United States are represented is very, very manichaeist. It's either everything is bad, everything is horrible, everything is devil about the U.S., you know.
Or is it a problem of stereotypes in your view, Annie?
Yeah, I think there's what I call the representation from the press is really deep fossilized images. And it's very hard to change that because, you know, I mean, all my friends who are journalists tell me that, you know, American journalists who report about France about France in the U.S. or vice versa, when, you know, okay, let's talk about French journalists reporting about the U.S., They try to give another image of the United States, but in France, their chiefs were asking them, just send a story about crimes. You know, that's the only thing we want to buy about the United States. We want to hear crimes, you know, crimes in Harlem. You know, it's a very difficult thing to change. So that's why I think that dealing with academic level, scientific level, with a longer-term relationship with students. And so it's extremely important.
Let Ezra in here, because I'm interested in knowing, Ezra, from this side of the Atlantic, whether or not stereotypes are also a part of the problem.
You know, part of the problem really is there's a kind of imbalance in this relationship. Americans don't really care that much about France. I mean, if you read an article recently that a British academic journalist, Tim Garton Ash, wrote in the New York Review of Books, he went around the country and he asked people about Europe. Well, you know, they just looked at him with a blank face, whether it was in Kansas or Wyoming and so on and so forth. So Americans are not preoccupied with France. the French are preoccupied with the United States. So this is something that's very, very grating on the French. The French, after all, have been used to seeing themselves as a world power. They are no longer a world power. They are no longer a major power. And whereas they were once an empire. And I think that that is partly at the root of the problem, where they're constantly kind of clinging on to try to be a major power, which is perfectly understandable. And they have some things going for them. The accidents of history have put them among the five major permanent members of the Security Council. So, of course, they play that to a hilt, and they're right to do so. But I think that that's part of the problem. Americans are not concerned with France, with anti-Americanism in France and so on, as much as the French are in the United States. If you get an article, Annie was talking about the press, and she's right. Well, if you get an article in the press about American cultures and so on, America is not up in arms about it. When you get an article in the New York Times that says something like maybe creativity, artistic creativity is no longer in Paris, but it's in New York and so on, well, you get a whole bunch of reactions to it. America is anti-French, et cetera, et cetera, you see? And there's this thing that sort of rankles, and it shows in the politics and in the diplomacy, as you called it, between the two countries.
Let me go back to Annie Cohen-Salal, if I can. The notion that France is no longer a world power, in fact, I think, as Ezra said, no longer a major power, does that feed the French frustration with the way America does wield its power?
Yeah, definitely. And it's even worse in the cultural field, because, you know, that's the field where the French have always felt superior to the Americans, and where the Americans for a long time felt inferior to the French. I could tell you exactly the split when Americans started to try and rival the French on the cultural level. It was at the Universal Exhibition in Chicago in 1893. It was the first time Americans tried to build a tower which would be higher than the Eiffel Tower. But, you know, before that, the French were really very secure and very arrogant with the Americans on the cultural level. I read a time in around 1850, the French were mocking the Americans, talking about them like bumpkins, that people who were judging paintings by the meter and sculpture by the pound, you know. And so things have changed radically. And when I was myself at the French Embassy in the United States, talking about, you know, the way American museums, American collections have become extraordinary within such a short time, you know, the French diplomats didn't want to talk about it. You know, it was a total taboo that French painters, for example, had disappeared from the museums of the world. And I thought, you know, why don't we talk about it? You know, the French don't like to touch their taboos. The French have real problems with dealing with their traumas, their historical traumas. They had trouble dealing with collaboration, the French collaboration with the Germans during the war. And we needed two American historians, Robert Paxton and Michael Maris, to do that. You know, we have trouble to deal with the Algerian War, with the trauma of the Algerian War, and we needed American historians to help us with that. So that's, and I think the cleavages, you spoke before about the tradition, the history and so on. I think the cleavages, there are a lot of different cleavages, but one of them which is important for me is that the religious cleavage, the ethical cleavage. There's a lot to say. There's so much to say about it.
I want to just go back to Ezra just with the idea of whether or not what we're looking at now is more of the same, or whether or not the splits that we're seeing with the name calling in the newspapers on both sides of the Atlantic is in some way different or worrisome.
I would definitely say it's worrisome. I would definitely say that in general, in terms of the relationship between the United States and its European allies, particularly in this case, France and Germany, I would refer to it as a major crisis. And we're not talking about the same thing, kind of stereotypes and weasels and cheese eating and all this stuff and so on and so forth. I think if you go outside of diplomats analyzing the situation or former government officials who say, well, you know, everything is basically deep down hunky-dory. We share the same values, and we have much more that unites us than divides us, and so on and so forth. You know, it's just kind of just a little a sort of superficial analysis. But I would say right now we are definitely in the midst of a crisis. So I think it has to be analyzed more on that level. What is it that the United States reproaches the French? What is it that the French actually stand for? And what is at the heart of the conflict? These are the real questions, and I'm happy to start answering them if you want. But
let me just ask Annie if she agrees with the list of questions that we're looking at here. Annie, I mean, are we facing a situation which is, for any particular reason, worrisome?
Yeah, I think that for everybody who's interested in these cross-cultural representations between France and the U.S., it's a normal phenomenon. It's like a rash. It's regular, but now it's stronger. It's a stronger rash, I would say. And one thing I think, Ezra, I don't know if you agree with me, has to do with Bush, has to do with the personality of George W. Bush. From the beginning, this guy was like a zombie for us. Was a kind of you know, it's a kind of guy.
And they loved Clinton. Yeah.
Exactly. I remember being invited by Clinton for his last White House conference. It was November, December, just before we knew the result of the elections. We didn't know yet whether Bush would be elected or not. And Clinton gathered a bunch of intellectuals, of people from all over the world. And you know, there was Yo-Yo Ma, and there was Zolinka,
yes,
and so on.
I remember.
And it was about, you remember, Ezra, it was about cultural diplomacy. And he was asking the model from the French and the Italians. And he thought, you know, it's wonderful to become a diplomat through culture, and we want to take them on. Something like that could never happen with Bush. Bush is the epitome of the Philistine, American Philistinism, like rejection of culture, rejection of art, rejection of intellectualism, and on original bases that come very far away in the American democracy, you know, like building on many things, the pioneer culture, the business culture, the Puritan culture, and so on and so forth. And I think that, and also the element that the French cannot understand is this religious aspect of Bush, you know. The fact that the speech he gave after the sad Columbia thing on Sunday, when he talked about stars, you know, that the people who had passed away were like stars now in the next to God. I mean, for the French, it's absolutely unbelievable. You know, we have had the separation between state and the church since 1905.
But Ezra Suleiman, this is who this man is. This man represents this country.
No, definitely. I mean, obviously, a conference like the one Annie referred to in the White House, where we were both present, could not happen today. In fact, I was surprised that it had not happened before under Clinton, and it was a shame that it had to happen at the very end of his term. But I want to go back to something else, which is not just the personality of Bush, because that really sort of does irk the French. But if he had had the right policies, or what the French would consider the right policies, everything would indeed be all right. The fact is, right now, for example, if you take the statement which really rankled not just the French, but the Germans also, when he referred to France and Germany as the old Europe, he also went on to say that this is, both of which have had problems, as he said. This is a very, very important message that he was giving. And, you know,
we'll pick that up when we come back after the break. We have to just take a short one here. Connection listeners, 1-800-423-8255. Taking the temperature of Franco-American relations and whether or not the war of words currently underway across the Atlantic is just more of the same or something that should be taken note of. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
From Boston.
You're listening to The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. This hour, a conversation about French and American relations. And Ezra Suleiman, you were just wrapping up a point as we went to the break.
I was just saying that, you know, when Rumsfeld made that statement about the old Europe, the Europeans think actually the new Europe is pretty good, that it's devoted to peace and so on. So they didn't quite know what he's talking about. He, in fact, was sending a very, very subtle message, or not so subtle, which was to say that the Germans have had their problems. He meant Nazism, of course, so they really don't have moral lessons to teach the world. As for the French, he was really talking about cowardice. They did not respond to the occupation of the Rhineland in 1936. So they encouraged Hitler to go on. They signed the Munich Pact. So they encouraged, they didn't stand up to Hitler again, and so on and so forth. And this is the kind of policy that doesn't work today. That's basically the message he sent them, which was, of course, a major insult. Now, if you talk to people in Washington and policymakers, and you ask them, what is this all about? And this has been going on for years. They will say to you, you know what? We support, we protect and we support the French, the Germans and the other Europeans. If you look at their defense budget, for example, ours is approximately 3.3% of GDP. Theirs is approximately 2%. So where does all the money go? The money goes to having a good life, to having 8-week vacations, to having a welfare state, to having free education, free medical health, to having a 35-hour week in France where work is deconsidered and so on and so forth, and we are footing the bill for this good life. That is what senators in Washington will tell you. And that is a very, very pointed criticism so that they can have their cake and eat it too. They can
criticize Ezra, let me just stop you there if I can, sure. Because I want to open up our conversation, let some listeners in. Let's go first to Needham, Massachusetts. Cindy's on the line. Hi, Cindy.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, you're welcome.
I'm married to a Frenchman, and I would like to address the current state of anti-French jokes on late-night TV. And in particular, there was one by Tina Fey, and she said basically the punchline was, send the French to North Korea. There are no Jews there. And my husband told me that in France they've had two prime ministers who were Jewish, yet in America we have yet to have a Jewish president. And then another theme about the French on late-night television is that they're all chickens. And my husband was telling me that in the First World War, they practically lost an entire generation of men. So I just wanted to know what your callers think of,
Let me ask Annie about the anti-Semitic references, because I suspect that a fair amount of the anger that exists between France and America right now does have its roots in part in the Middle East, where the Americans are seen by the French as favoring Ariel Sharon and the Israeli government to the detriment of the Palestinians. And on the flip side, the French, the Americans see the French as coddling the Palestinians too much. Would you agree with that?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And I've heard very often among Americans that the French were people who did go with the German police in, the Vélodrome d'Hiver in July 1942 and gave the young Jewish children to the Gestapo, you know. So the French police was even worse than the Gestapo. And the fact that the French policy is totally different towards the Middle East and much more pro-Palestinian. That makes Americans, representation of the French as anti-Semites much, much stronger. I don't think, though, it's true. I don't think that France is turning into there's a wave of anti-Semitism. I don't know what Ezra thinks about it, but I don't think so.
No, I would agree with Annie. I don't think there is a wave of anti-Semitism. I think, on the other hand, the French, again, this is one of their frustrations, mm-hmm. that they have not been able to broker a peace or play any role of any significance in resolving the Israel-Palestinian conflict. They've been sort of out of the loop there, and partly because they really don't have the legitimacy to do it. They have been so pro-Palestinian, I'm talking about the government policy, that they just don't have any weight in the Middle East.
Broaden that, though, couldn't we, Ezra, to look at Bosnia and say that the French and the Europeans were unable to find any kind of unanimity there to resolve that. The Americans had to come in.
the Americans had to come in, but they finally did. I mean, reluctantly did finally go in. But it's true that there is a resentment that the Americans are always present everywhere. But what I'm referring particularly in the Israeli-Palestinian situation, the French feel, given their historical background in the Middle East, they really should have had a role. But I think they also are not aware that they have actually excluded themselves, and they have a total misunderstanding, and I have to be very, very clear about that, as far as the Israeli-Palestinian conflict goes. They simply liken it to their role in Algeria. So they see Israel as an occupier that humiliates, subordinates, beats up on the Palestinians, something that they know a lot about in Algeria, and they simply see a parallel between the Algerian situation, their rule in Algeria, and the Israeli rule in the Palestinian territories.
Okay, Ezra, I want to go back to the phones to Malden, Massachusetts now. James on the line. Hi, James.
Hey, Dick, this is a wonderful show, and your guests are both wonderful. I'm an American, but I lived for over 9 years in Europe, partly as a child. I lived in France as a child. My mother is from the French Texas-Louisiana border. She speaks French and English. And I both the guests are wonderful. I have to say, Annie, she's courageous. She's like a cultural heroine to me, because I love France. I really do. And for me, this is painful. But I think you can use one word to not everything we're talking about here, because I think George Bush does have problems. And Americans, definitely, we have many problems. Americans, we're not perfect. We have problems. I'm liberal. I criticize America a lot. But I think there's one word to describe some of this problem in France. The only word you can possibly use is hate, that it's a problem of hate, and it has to be called hate.
You mean French hatred of the Americans?
Yes, yes, and also this young lady who called before, we do it too. We are also responsible for this. This poor man who married an American girl and had to hear this hate on TV late at night, that's wrong too. That's hate. But it's yes, we have different cultural points of view. There are legitimate differences. Some of the French criticisms of America are very good. But the thing is, as long as the hate is there, we will never hear the very good criticisms coming from the French. We will not be able to learn from the French as long as there's so much hate coming from the French at the same time.
Annie, do you agree that the word hatred is a useful word here?
I think there's resentment. I think the French, the kind of personality that General de Gaulle was representing.
Yes.
That, you know, there was the Marshall Plan, which was able to help Europeans to rebuild this disaster that Europe was. There was the GIs who landed in Normandy and helped us to recuperate a free state. You know, all that made us dependent from you guys, you know. And there's always some resentment coming from dependency. Yeah. But I must tell you something else. There are other people who know that. And I remember in my job as a French at the French embassy, I asked one of my predecessors what was the most beautiful time between France and the U.S. on the cultural level. And he said that's where André Malraux brought La Joconde to the United States. And André Malraux had been fascinated by Jackie Kennedy and decided to send the Joconde to the U.S. And he made a beautiful speech at the White House under the Kennedy administration. And he said, I have been criticized by the French deputies to bring over this beautiful treasure from the 15th century to the United States. But what I do here, the danger to put La Joconde on the paquebot France is much less than the lives of these young GIs that were lost on Normandy beaches, you know? So there are some, from time to time, you know, these attempts to be grateful to the American gesture, you know, in all kinds of levels. You know, there are people who are trying to do that. We have, you know, it's...
This is,
it's,
in fact, partly where I wanted to go here, and that is both with you, Annie, and Ezra, to measure the weight of the criticism here. From France, it appears much of the criticism of America comes from the left. From the United States, much of it comes from the right. But does it, or is it spreading? Does it represent a larger part of the population than it has in the past? Ezra, maybe you can begin.
Well, I think many people have said that the criticism of the United States in France comes mostly from the left. I actually would not agree with that. I think there is a lot of anti-Americanism, both on, and there's a long tradition of that, both on the left and on the right. It's very, very rare. There are many people who remember, and he says, what the United States has done to liberate Europe and so on and so forth. But of course, that also made Europe and France dependent on the United States after the war. But at the same time, during that same time, there was already a lot of anti-Americanism. I mean, you know, right after the war in 1947, 48, when the Marshall Plan began, there was, in fact, a rumor that was spread that America was actually putting poison in Coca-Cola in order to poison French people. And there was actually a parliamentary commission, believe it or not, that exonerated the Coca-Cola company from wanting to poison the French population. It was a sort of communist rumor that was spread and so on, and that picked up. So you've had, and then from de Gaulle on the right, a definite anti-Americanism. So they sort of both share it in a way. And you never find in France today any politician who, or anybody, an intellectual even, who will actually, or it's very, very rare, let's put it that way, who will actually come up and defend. It is politically incorrect to defend the United States.
And Annie, where do the people sit here? Where are the people? Go ahead, Annie.
Yeah, no, I do. I do refuse these critics, both from the right and from the left. And I try to give a picture of the United States, which is mature, which is informed, which is realistic. And to tell you the truth, the first thing I did in my university is ordering two sets of video cassettes of tapes of documentaries. One, the whole sets of documentaries made by Fred Wiseman, because it's a wonderful sociological approach of the United States today. And the whole sets of documentaries made by Ken Burns on history. And I think that could give an image of a more realistic America. You know, I am not, Ezra, you know that. I'm not.
No, not you.
It's not
course.
Defending.
I'm not referring
it's
to
not,
you.
You know, I don't feel like defending or attacking. I feel like, you know, getting to a more mature relationship, you see? I mean, getting to another stage, you know? I mean, you know, ideology is gone. I mean, you cannot imagine what it is in Le Monde Diplomatique, you know, nonstop every month. You get, if Americans have these great foundations for philanthropy, it's because they have guiltiness feelings. You know, you always try and find some kind of psychological explanation to attack the Americans. It's ridiculous.
Let's go back to the lines now. To Columbia, South Carolina, Colin's joining us. Hi, Colin.
Hello, how you doing?
I'm fine. Thanks for calling.
Well, I'm a professor of European studies and military history, so I find this, and an author of a couple of books, and on this topic to some degree, so I find both your guests very compelling and very enlightened. The question that I have is an argument that I support, and when I teach, is that France, like Britain and most great empires, upon losing those empires, suffers an identity crisis. And after two world wars and negative results on the French side due to those disastrous events and the American interventions, do your guests feel that the resulting effects of, say, the Marshall Plan and the American military presence in Europe to support and defend against the Warsaw Pact alliance have anything to do with the dependency notion that the French may have with regard to their loss of A, empire, B, the dependency, and C, their feeling of inadequacy due to their loss of prestige in the world?
Ouch. Ezra, that's a pretty heavy burden to bear.
It is. I mean, I think there's definitely, of course, as your caller suggests, any country that loses an empire has to make an adjustment. The British had their way of doing it. They created a Commonwealth and so on. The French had their way of doing it. They developed nuclear weapons. They did all sorts of things. They didn't talk too much about the war, et cetera, et cetera. So there are always those kinds of problems that have to be dealt with. But independently, there is also the dependence, of course, on, that this has resulted in the United States. So I think that that is definitely an issue, the question of an identity crisis, and what do you do after you've lost your empire, and how do you keep your spirits up, and how do you play a role in the world? And the French have always wanted to play a role. They feel they have something to say. They feel they have something to contribute. But they realize in today's world, where you have China, where you have India, where you have Brazil, and so on and so forth, they're actually a small country. And one of the ways that they decided to do it, but without fully accepting it, unfortunately, is to throw their lot in with Europe. So they have, on the one hand, one foot inside Europe, and on the other hand, one foot outside of Europe, where they still want their individuality to count.
And Annie, is this the dilemma that France faces at this moment, for in terms of, you know, do they stay offside on the Iraq issue, refusing to join with any sort of coalition? Is there a risk that France will further marginalize itself?
Yes, I think that I would agree with what Ezra said, but said differently when he said that both countries want to play a role. I think when the very unique thing which makes France and the United States similar is that both countries have always had a feeling of the universal, of a claim for a universal order. They want an imperialism of the universal. They're trying to show their order in the world. And therefore, as long as the French have lost that, they really still feel that they could do it. And that's why, in a way, the political scene, the world order is some place where they have showed recently, as we have said, that they cannot anymore. You know,
the French have tried with an alliance of Francophone countries called La Francophonie. Has that failed?
It's not exactly a great enterprise, I must say. You know, I mean, and also, you know, I think that also the relationship between Blair and Bush is so strong. And today I was telling Ezra before that the show began that I saw the meeting which is taking place right now between Chirac and Blair. They couldn't meet in December because they were so far apart, and they met in a French station today. I mean, it's terrible. You know, the relationship are so cold now. So, and especially because the French have always had also a very great suspicion of the British, you know, the traitor of the British and the war of 100 years from the British. So that the link between the British and the Americans is making even worse for
it
the French.
It's all linked in history. 1-800-423-8255. Connection listeners, brings you into our conversation about the deterioration in relations between France and America. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
Funding for The Connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR News.
You're listening to The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. What's behind the ill will that currently exists between France and the United States? In your view, Connection listeners, is it more of the usual bashing, or is there some new edge to it that should be taken note of? With me on the program today, Ezra Suleiman. He's professor of international studies and director of the Committee for European Studies at Princeton University. Annie Cohen-Solal is also with us. She's professor at the School of Advanced Studies in Social Sciences in Paris and chair of American Studies at the University of Caen in Normandy. Let's go to the phones to Salem, New Hampshire, and Brian's joining us. Hi, Brian.
Hi, Brian. How are you doing?
I'm fine, thanks.
I'm Brian.
Okay, I'll be Dick.
I've never been on a show before. Thank you very much.
Thanks for calling.
So one of the things that I learned about French, I had to work with a French division of our company, a large computer company, for about 7 years.
Yeah.
And the first few months I worked with them, they would drive me up the wall because one of the things we never could do is make a decision. Like, Americans always want to make decisions. And after a few months, I was ready to give up. And one of the managers over there took me aside and said, "Don't you understand the way we think? We go to school and we learn the Socratic method of thinking, of asking questions constantly. We could never get to a point where we'd make a decision that would stick." And once I understood that, I was able to listen to them. They taught me how to listen better, too, and be able to come back to them and say, "Okay, what questions do you have?" And my point is that it seems like they think the Americans are just telling them what's going to happen versus we want to talk about this more. and they feel as though they're isolated and not being able to ask the questions over and over again and get them answered. They just said the American way of let's go do something.
Annie, what do you think?
Yeah, it's extremely interesting because, first of all, you made a diagnosis of the problem and then you noticed what was wrong and you could find a solution. It's very true that the educations are extremely different. The French is a country which is geared towards its past. It's past, grandeur. And if I were to put it in one sentence, I would say the French try to preserve a tradition, whereas the Americans try to find a market. Americans are, it's a country which is geared towards action, towards money, towards efficiency. The French couldn't care less about efficiency. You know what the weekend was about? The whole weekend was about demonstrations for retirement, demonstrations for pensions, the whole last year, people were speaking about this, 35-hour week and all this. You know, people are interested in France about leisure, about pleasure, about discussions, but discussions without any end, you see.
So, Annie, this is what Ezra was saying earlier in the program, that the view from Washington, and not just from the columnists there, but from the politicians, is that, we're investing X amount of dollars in military that will keep the world safe, and all you're worried about is how quickly you can get in the car and get out to the countryside on the weekend. Is it a legitimate criticism?
It's not as easy because how many people do you have without health support in the United States? Who is taking care of the public transportation, of the public problems? It's two different attitudes towards society. You see,
just one other comment. It's once we did make a decision finally after I learned how to deal with them, and it wasn't always absolutely smooth, but at least I knew where they were coming from. And once we got to a point where, is this the decision, they moved on it. And it was no problem after that. But I was always expecting the next level.
Go ahead, Ezra.
Can we just get back for a moment to the question you asked a moment ago, which was about the French-American tiff, if you will, as far as Iraq is concerned right now, because this is really at the heart of the issue at the moment. I think that the French have sent mixed signals. During the 2 months while they were working up, the UN was working up towards Resolution 1441, the French played a very, very important role. They played a very, very constructive role, actually. They helped the United States. It was a pragmatic decision that something that Blair has long recognized, that if you want weigh in with the United States, you have to give them support so that later on you are also able to oppose them on other things. And the French seem to have taken that lesson to heart, which is a very big change from the previous foreign policy where, a minister or a foreign minister would get up, make some declaration, and that would be the end of that and nothing would happen. It's what Kissinger called over 30 years ago the politics of futility. That is, you give yourself a little satisfaction, a little pat on the back, but nothing actually happens and you don't accomplish anything. And in the UN, with the resolution 1441, the French actually seem to have, understood something. Now, since last week, where they seem to be siding more with the Germans, the Americans sort of throw their hands up and say, what the hell is going on? And now they've reverted back to systematically opposing us. And I think Chirac actually has gotten himself, the French president, in something of a pickle since this signing of the letter by the 8 European countries, whom he didn't consult, who are very upset with him, and who have now sided with the United States. So he is in a very, very difficult position. The question is, will he go in finally, if the United States decides to go to war, or won't he go in? Will he be at the table? Will he throw in his lot with the United States? That, I think, is the question. My answer is probably that he will. The corollary to that is that Bush is a fairly vindictive guy, and he may tell him, we no longer need you. And then what?
We'll see. 1-800-423-8255. I want to go back to the calls. Chatham County, North Carolina. Nick's been waiting on the phone. Hello, Nick.
Hi.
Thanks for calling.
The question I have to ask is, Europe goes towards unifying in the European Union as a sovereign state of some sort or another. they may be looking to declare their independence, so to speak, from the United States, which they've been dependent, Europe has been somewhat dependent upon the United States for a long time, and this may be a way of preparing the ground psychologically for that move. In effect, by going against the United States in this, it is a declaration of independence of a certain kind for the EU, and France and Germany as the two powers who put together the EU to begin with. I don't know how conscious they are of this, but they might very well be.
Are they then any leading the EU further away from any kind of political relationship with the United States? Well, is it a declaration in some way of independence?
I think they're going to have a political relationship with the United States, but it's kind of a declaration of their independence, that they're no longer dependent upon the United States in any sort of way to make their opinion.
Okay, let's go to Annie first and then to Ezra.
I think we might be going a little bit too far for me. I think that, truly, the French disagree on this obsession with Saddam Hussein that Bush seems to have. I think that I remember the previous war of Bush's father, February 1991. And I remember that we had the French news in New York that people were able to see, and the French news of Antenne 2. And a lot of people would tell me, a lot of Americans would tell me, but you know, it's so much more interesting the way the French deal with the Middle East, because they have experts from the Middle East who describe to us what's going on, who tell us about the Arab countries, and it helps us understand the situation much better, whereas on American television we just see generals giving numbers and so on. So we have a totally different way of analyzing the situation. And I think, you know, on one hand, it's not only this kind of power and weakness that Robert Kagan talked about between Europe and the United States. It's something more. You know, I think it's a real disagreement on a political situation.
Ezra, let me hear from you for a moment, if I can.
Well, I think that there is definitely, as your caller raised, the question of whether the European Union is in fact strong enough to pull away from the United States and become a force on its own. This, I think, was the hope of some Europeans. But, you know, when you have a Europe that's no longer 6 countries or 12 countries or 15 countries, but we're now talking 25 countries by 2005 and likely to raise to be 30 countries, this Europe is no longer united. It is not even unitable in that sense. And the fact we see it right under our noses right now, where 8 countries have very, very categorically distance themselves from the Germans and the French and thrown in their lot with the United States in no uncertain terms. And I have to emphasize one thing, which is one of the signatories to that letter or article, or what Sapphire calls op-ed diplomacy, was Vaclav Havel. And Havel is, you know, a giant in terms of as a moral, ethical, intellectual leader in Europe. He was until a couple of days ago. So that when he says you can maintain your ethics and at the same time you must know when to use power,
Let me just, if I can, go back to Annie on why it is that we should care, why it's important that the relations between French and America not be allowed to deteriorate to the sort of name-calling that we're seeing. Why is it important to work to preserve the relations there, Annie, in your view?
I think that Europe has been the core of the culture. I think Americans have created the American democracy, leaving Europe, and because they resented so many things in the corruption of the Catholic Church, the European monarchies, and we Europeans think of Americans like a part of us. Now, if the split becomes wider and more serious, then it's a whole, message of Europe which is lost in a way. And I mean, I have myself felt the divorce for a long time, that we're really going wider apart, Europe and the United States. For the Europeans, it's very sad. I think for Americans, it's been always in their constituency to build themselves against some rejection of Europe. So I think that's not that important for Americans. For Europeans, it's terrible.
Ezra, what is lost in the United States, though, if the deterioration continues?
I think it. One thing we do have to bear in mind, that the world is a dangerous world. Yeah. It's a dangerous place. European, American values of democracy, of liberty, and so on and so forth, these are the countries that speak to those. And I think a lot will be lost. The United States will set a bad example by flouting international law. Sometimes you do have to do it, but you have to work yourself up to that. And it seems to me that the United States has a lot to gain by trying to bring Europe in, by trying to convince Europe to stay into, I wouldn't say to its orbit, but at least to share its goals and so on. And the United States is actually guilty of not having done any of that. It's very, very simple. Either you're with us or you're not with us, in which case you're against us. The world since September 11th has drastically changed, and that's the message that the United States has been trying to get out. Unfortunately, it does it with such a heavy hand that the Europeans, of course, become even more resentful. And this makes us lose sight of the real problems that we are both confronted with.
Annie, I know one of the frustrations from the European perspective is that since September 11th, it's not that the world has changed, but that America has changed.
Yeah, absolutely. For the first time, this country was not, you know, was reachable by pain. It's a country which saw its city destroyed. And in a way, it was sharing the same culture as European cities, which were bombed and destroyed during the war. So it, in a way, I mean, paradoxically and sadly, it made us more similar. And paradoxically, it put us more apart.
I want to thank both of you for being with us. We will be watching this relation, and your words have given us some guidance. Annie Cohen-Salah, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Annie teaches American Studies at the School of Advanced Study in Social Sciences in Paris and at the University of Caen in Normandy. Ezra Suleiman, thank you for your time as well.
Thank you.
Ezra's a professor of politics and international relations at Princeton University. Connection listeners, you're welcome to continue the conversation in our online forums. We're at theconnection.org. Special thanks to Stephen Schultz and Natalie Lennon at Princeton for their technical help. And we had help today from Kim Bachari, Dara Manoogian, and Brian Myers, and Carl Volker. Our program's produced by Sean Carberry, Sarah Field, Elaine Grant, Kelly Jones, Arit Karisky-Fox, Lindsay Miller, Christina Russo, and Doug Sugarts. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
Funding for The Connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. To purchase cassettes and CDs of The Connection, please visit www.theconnection.org or phone 1-800-909-9287.